We're turning to Proverbs chapter 15, verses 16 and 17. And our first heading is the foundation of a happy home. Proverbs 15, 16 and 17. And I'm reading from the authorized version. Proverbs 15, verse 16. Better is little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a stalled ox and hatred therewith. There's a lot in those two little verses. There is no question that here, in these two little snippets of Solomon, are the sources of a truly happy home and also a truly happy heart. Here is a continual feast every day of your life. So satisfying that the believer's, quote, little is better than the worldling, the unbeliever's all. The saint's little is better than the worldling's all. Jesus did say, a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. But nobody wants to listen to him. Your life, he said, is not the abundance of personal possessions. But his generation and our generation, from Roman days until now and before it, just don't want to know about that. I've been considering this little verse 16 much. Better is little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith. Here is a fellow or a girl, a man or a woman, a little boy or a girl, who fears the Lord. They hold the Lord in reverence and in awe. And if it be only little that he has, well, that little is not from the lack of his father's care and love, but because if he only has a little in life, he appreciates that God's wisdom knows what he really needs, so he hasn't allowed him to have it. And that everything beyond what God would allow him to have would be a temptation and a snare to him. That's why the Christian fellow or girl can learn contentment. The man or woman can learn contentment. Because if they only have a little, in comparison with what many around them may seem to have, they know that they don't have much say in personal possessions because God has not allowed them to have it, because it would be a snare to them. Other Christians may be allowed a lot more of personal possessions because God allows it to them, because they can handle it. Anyway, is the unbelieving heart ever satisfied? You know, I don't want to sound vindictive or anything, but I shall never forget that interview that Richard Burton gave recently on television where he spoke of earning millions upon millions of pounds in 1 year. Was he satisfied? No, he spent it all in 1 year. And Christ died for him just like he died for me. So let's not try and be any arrogant or holier than thou in our attitude. But as I listened to Richard Burton say that, you know, it is absolutely true. If your heart knows not the Lord, the universe wouldn't satisfy you if you had it. It is said of Alexander the Great, who conquered the world before he was 32, the then known world, that he sat down and wept after he had won all these lands and countries and nations, sat down and wept because there were no more lands to conquer. And yet, those who know and love the Lord, a little from the Lord will satisfy them. I think of C.T. Studd. I was thinking of him today, you know, who played cricket for England, and he gave away a fortune of £20,000. You can imagine what that would be worth now, and he gave half of it to the Salvation Army and the other half to something else, and away went to China to serve the Lord, and died emaciated in Africa, eventually, as a Christian Bible teacher and preacher. And I am told that around his graveside, I'm told there were thousands of people, thousands of Africans who had come to know Christ through his witness. Who was the rich man? See, so often in this world that we're living in, this that I am preaching is totally against the temperature in this city and the world around us. Jim Elliot's word, and I met a man who heard him say this, the fellow who was martyred for Christ in Ecuador in 1956. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Is a very foolish statement. But it's still true. Better is little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith. There must be trouble with great treasure without the fear of the Lord. Abraham had a lot of treasure, but he feared the Lord. Letourneau had a lot of treasure in America, but he used it for the Lord. Joseph of Arimathea had treasure and wealth, but he used it for God. But trouble must come, the implication is, with great treasure, if you have not the fear of the Lord in your heart. It is inevitable. I read a little statement by a great Puritan this week, and I thought it was good. Jacob's ladder, which conveys to heaven, may have its foot in the smoking cottage. And of course, those are the olden days when chimneys weren't as sophisticated. Jacob's ladder, which conveys to heaven, may have its foot in the smoking cottage. Some of the poorest of this world are the richest and the happiest people on the face of the earth. I remember Billy Graham speaking on one occasion about going to a very wealthy island, or an island where was a tax haven, if I remember right, for a lot of rich men. And he visited a man who didn't know Christ, who owned a lot of money. And he said, I sat in his house and I heard him moan and groan and complain. And then he said, I met a poor man on the other side of the island who lived in a hovel, and I visited him. And after I'd visited them both, I said to myself, who was the rich man? As to this world's comforts, according to verse 17, a dinner of herbs where love is better than a whole lot of steaks, as it were, from an ox, and hatred therewith. A dinner of herbs, that homely, simple meal of love, is far better than the stalled ox. Why, some of you fellas on this beautiful, beautiful spring evening are in love. Don't deny it. And you know that Coke you had with your beloved today would beat the biggest feast that you've ever had in the largest hotel at everybody else's wedding. Why? Because you love her. Even an ice cream tastes better when you're in love. And that's the way God wanted it. I remember standing gazing at that picture called A Marriage of Convenience, where there's a beautiful Victorian home with a huge table. I remember going down once on one occasion to the south of Ireland with a friend of mine, and we were visiting in that lovely home at Powers Court, the home of the Schlesingers, and some of them had become Christians, and one of the lads in there in that family had invited us in for the afternoon to meet his mum and dad. And we went into that beautiful home. And as we sat there in Powers Court, there was a huge table, and I was here, and my friend was about halfway down this church building at the other end, and he said to me, "Would you pass the salt, brother?" And I always remember him saying that to me. This picture was of a huge kind of table like that. And there's a beautifully dressed woman sitting in the painting at one end of the table and a well-dressed man at the other end. And she's got her head down and he's got his head down. And underneath is the word, a marriage of convenience. There was a long way between them. And the implication is that either he or she married for money. Sumptuous meal, beautiful house, exquisite clothes, and misery. Better a dinner of herbs where love is than a stalled ox and hatred therewith. You know, love sweetens the very meanest food, and hatred embitters the very richest feast. It was very humble fare that the two on the way to Emmaus had when the Lord of the universe broke the bread in their house. It doesn't seem to me to be a meal of meat or a stalled ox that had been slain and the meat brought to the table. He breaks the bread. But I'll tell you, it may have been humble fare with those two of Emmaus, but how that humble fare was dignified by the presence of the Lord. And when the Lord's ordinance of marriage, and mark what I say, is marred by a man's selfishness, and when wealth and rank and adventitious accomplishments govern the choice of a life partner and a companion for life rather than the fear of the Lord, is it any wonder if the stalled ox and hatred therewith is the order of a house like that? Girls, whatever you do, don't marry a man just for his social rank. Fellas, whatever you do, don't just marry a girl just because she's beautiful or just because she has a lot of social graces. I'm warning you in God's presence. Sweet talk in your ear on a summer's night is lovely as you sit beside him. But after you get married, there's lots of meeting after that. Lots of it. And if you fellas or girls know the Lord Jesus as your Savior, and you do not marry that partner first and foremost because they know the Lord, and I'm not implying by that the first girl you meet, you say, "Excuse me, dear, are you saved? Yes. Will you marry me?" That would be very silly. That's not what I'm implying. But if that all-important point is not there and you marry for those other things, you'll be sorry. If you had to sit where I've got to sit and listen to what I've got to listen to, you would know that what I'm saying is true. Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. And of course, there are very few people who actually believe this divine testimony. They just don't believe it. And if parents seek the real solid happiness of their children, then let parents, and this applies to me too, let them lead their children to expect little from this world and everything from God. Parents, mark what I'm saying. Do you teach your children that there is much to be expected from this world's glory and fame or whatever, or position? You're foolish if you do. Do you teach your children that the best things are to be had from God? And that God will never disappoint you? I am glad that I had a mother who used to rush into my room many a time when I was sitting doing my homework or whatever at school with her Bible in hand and said, "Son, did you notice this verse?" Many a time I have come home from work and even from school and even in childhood opened the door to find my mother on her knees. A godly father and a godly mother are wonderful to have, who teach you to expect great things from God. Is that the kind of parent you're going to be? Is that the kind of parent I'm going to be? And speaking of children, let's turn to Proverbs 22 and 15. Love in a marriage is the secret, and the fear of the Lord the foundation. And now they are married and they have children in the will of God. It's not the will of God for all couples to have children, but it is in the will of God for some. Proverbs 22 and 15, probably one of the most controversial verses in all of Proverbs. Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. Now, James Dobson, whose tremendous insights into the whole question of the discipline of children, tells the story that on one occasion he got into a bus. And as he was sitting in the bus, it stopped at a stop, and this lady got in. And he recounts how that she got in with 7 boisterous children. Boarded this bus in Los Angeles. And he says that the lady sat in the seat behind him, and her hair was an absolute mess, a bit like mine. Her hair was an absolute mess, and she had a very gaunt look on her face that, quite frankly, he said, revealed a state of utter exhaustion. And as she stumbled past Dr. Dobson to sit in the seat behind him, he was kind of sorry for her, I think, on the hot day, so he quipped, he said, "Excuse me, ma'am," he said, "but do all these children belong to you, or is this some kind of picnic?" And she looked at him, he says, through sunken eyes, very soberly, and said, "They're all mine, and believe me, it's no picnic, sir." Yes. The Lord Mayor's show was going past here on Saturday, and my twins were out there along with another friend's twins and our other children and our 2 families, and we were all sitting together, and they'd brought little chairs along with them. And there was a man standing, and I could see him gazing upon this. And he looked at my wife, and he looked at the children, and he looked at my... He says, are they all yours, dear? And Margaret was praising the Lord that she was able to say that no, she shared them with another family for sure. 7 children, and no picnic. Let me give to you what I believe is the most accurate definition of what it is like to bring up small children. Now, those of you here with starry eyes tonight heading for marriage, you're not thinking about this. And why should you? We don't want to dampen your enthusiasm in any way. Tom is about to get married, and I want to encourage him all I can. But whenever you head for marriage, nobody ever tells you that at nights when your children are born, the pair of you, well, your husband and wife, will go to bed together with searing headaches. And you will be lowered into bed slowly. Sometimes I wish I had a crane to do it. And as you sink down into the bed together, you wonder what on earth it is all about. And Swindle, I think, is one of the very best contemporary Christian writers in the world at the moment. And he wrote an essay on this, and I think it is just the thing. Here's the bee's knees description of what it's like. I certainly couldn't describe it like this. Hear Charles Swindle, the great Bible teacher, express his hope. Someday, when the children are grown, things are going to be a lot different. The garage won't be full of bikes and nails and hammers and a saw and unfinished experimental projects and the rabbit cage. And you won't half break your neck on the skateboards lying around. Someday, when the children are grown, the kitchen will be incredibly neat. The sink will stay free of sticky, gooey dishes. The fridge won't be clogged with 9 bottles of milk. We won't lose the top of all the ketchup bottles. How ketchup bottles exercise your prayer life. Margarine tops. Mustard bottle tops. Someday, when the children are grown, my wife will have time to dress leisurely. A long bath without 3 panic interruptions. Time to do her nails without answering a dozen questions and reviewing spelling words. Someday, when the children are grown, the instrument called a telephone will actually be available. It will simply hang there, silently, amazingly available. Someday, when the children are grown, I'll be able to see through the car windows. Tom arrived at my house yesterday when my 3 children were helping me to wash the car. Wash it? I declare to you it was 10 times filthier after they had finished with it than it was before they started. Yes, says Swindle, the back seat in the car won't be a disaster area. We won't get in on our way to meetings, as it were, and sit on crayons anymore. And broken potato crisps. How I have to try and pick them out of that back seat. They're ingrained in there, it seems, almost for eternity. You can't get them out. And says Swindle, someday when my children are grown, the tank, that is the petrol tank, will not always be somewhere between empty and fumes. Someday, when the children are grown, we will return to normal conversations. It's my turn, won't call out for a referee, and a magazine article will be read in full without interruption, and discussed at length without Mom and Dad having to hide in the attic to finish the conversation. Believe me, he's not far out of it, and some don't have an attic. Someday, when the children are grown, things are going to be different. One by one, they will leave the nest, our nest. The clink of china will be heard on occasion in our house once more. The house will be quiet and calm and always clean. No more little green squashed peas on the carpet anymore. Clean and empty and filled with memories and lonely. And we, my wife and I, will spend our time not looking forward to someday, but looking back to yesterday and thinking, maybe we can babysit the grandchildren and get some life back into this place for a change. Yes. Small children have more energy in their little fat fingers than mother has in her entire weary body. Children are expensive little people. One of mine swallowed a penny the other day. And to raise them properly in the nurture and admonition of the Lord will require the very best that you can give of your time and your effort and your financial resources. When our first child was born, the mother of a member of this Bible class sent us a beautiful card. And in the card she wrote, "The most important commodity that you can give to your child is your time." My father-in-law said to me just after I was married and the children started to come, he said to me, "For any sakes, Derek, spend time with them." He said, "They will be up and away on you before you know where you are." He said, "You'll be amazed how the years pass." I was preaching in a tent one night in Liverpool, and a lovely mother, an older lady, pulled me aside. She said, "Derry, can I give you a word of advice? Make every day count with your children. Every day, because they'll be gone before you realize it." Some fathers waking up too late to discover that they don't know their children. Their children are gone. They have never been at home. Business was too important. Money was the god. And they spend gobs of money on their children at Christmas and buy them huge electronic toys at £50, £100 each, bring them home, and their children play with a cardboard box that came in. And they say, "They're not interested in it." Ah, no. Simpler things like taking time with them, swing on a swing with them, putter in a motorboat with them, seesaw on a seesaw with them, or whatever, is far more important in this day than any other is. Far more important. And of course, to those who have never experienced parenthood, if you've never experienced parenthood, it really appears the very simplest thing in the world. Those people who don't have any children, they'll tell you how to bring them up. They have wonderful ideas about how their children should be handled. If you've never experienced parenthood, it seems so amazingly simple. And by the way, the heat's turned off, so it's not going to get any warmer. It is, in fact, very costly. It is, in fact, very complex to bring children up. Far more costly and far more complex than some people realize. But then nothing that was ever worth having ever came cheap. And children are worth the price. So I'm warning you. Now, here are, written before you in your notes, some guidelines that I have taken from Dr. Dobson's famous book, Dare to Discipline. And here are some guidelines which I think would be tremendously useful and helpful to you when the experience of raising children, or if you have children at the moment, is with you. Here are the guiding principles to guide you in raising boys and girls for the Lord. In safety and health. The first point is that children are aware of the content or the contest of wills between generations. Kids are very well aware that there's a war on, of wills. And that is precisely why the parental response is so important. And when a child behaves in ways that are highly disrespectful or harmful to himself or others, and he's really ripping and rebelling against you, parent, his actually hidden purpose is often to find out if you really meant that threat. If you really mean that he's not allowed to do that. That you have really drawn the boundary lines. See, here's a policeman. He's going along. He's trying all the doors at night. Is he hoping they'll be open? Has he tried all the doors in some industrial estate? Of course not. He's hoping they'll be locked. And when a child begins to assault his parents' authority, he is greatly reassured when he discovers that their leadership holds firm and is confident, and that they have meant what they have said. A child finds lovely security in the cocoon of a structural environment where the rights of other people and his own rights are protected by boundaries that his mum and dad have drawn. So, when you're raising children, define the boundaries before they are enforced. That's vital. Point A. You must, whatever you're doing when it comes to discipline, you must define the boundaries, because the most important step in any disciplinary procedure is to establish reasonable expectations and boundaries in advance, that the child knows how far it can go. And if it steps over that line, it's in trouble, and that you will make sure it's in trouble. And this precondition will eliminate the overwhelming sense of injustice that a youngster feels when somebody slaps him or punishes him for accidents, things he didn't mean, mistakes, blunders. If you haven't defined it, then don't enforce it. Got that? It's very important. If suddenly you bang a child, or you're mad with a child, or desperately scream at it or something, and parents have been known to do worse, about something wrong they have done, but you have never told the child it was wrong, or established a boundary around that situation, that's terrible. So define the boundaries before they are enforced. Now, when you lay out the boundaries, and when you have it defined, and the little one comes along, or the much bigger one comes along, and defiantly challenges your authority, you must respond quickly, and you must respond decisively. Once a child understands what's expected of it, he should then be held accountable for behaving accordingly. But then most children will assault the authority of their elders and challenge the elders' right to lead. They'll always do that automatically. So, my friends, when you are in a nose-to-nose confrontation, eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation with your children, and they have defiantly rebelled against those boundaries you've set, it is extremely important for you to win decisively and confidently. When he starts spoiling for a fight, don't disappoint him, says Dr. Dobson. Nothing is more destructive to parental leadership than for a mother or father to disintegrate during that struggle. When the parent consistently loses those battles of confrontation, resorting to tears and screaming and other evidence of their frustration. No, what can I do about you? I can't do anything about you. Hello, what am I going to do with you? I'm tearing a wallpaper practically, or their hair. You can see where I am now. Yes, it is very true. Foolishness, and let's be serious, foolishness aside, some dramatic changes take place in the way parents are seen by their children when parents say, don't do it or you'll be punished, and then they do it and they're not punished. Then the child begins to get a different view of his mom and dad. And instead of being secure and confident leaders in their home, they become spineless jellyfish who are unworthy of any respect or allegiance because they don't mean what they say and say what they mean. So if you draw the boundary and set up punishments that the child is warned, then you'd better apply them. Then, of course, thirdly, you must distinguish between willful defiance and childish irresponsibility. You see, a child should never, ever be spanked for behavior that is not willfully defiant. Never. Childish irresponsibility is a very different thing from willful defiance and should be handled far more patiently. And parents have to learn before God to distinguish what is childish irresponsibility and immaturity from that which is willful defiance. The verse I read to you in the Word of God, Proverbs 22:15, says, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. Foolishness in that verse is not childishness. It's not childishness. You know that famous quote of Paul's in 1 Corinthians 13? When I was a child, I spake as a child, I thought as a child, I understood as a child. When he is giving that, there's no moral guilt attached to that statement. He's not saying I was wrong for thinking as a child, speaking as a child, understanding as a child, thinking as a child. No moral guilt associated with that. A child is not to be punished, according to this verse, for being a child. Punishment is to be administered for being a disobedient child. Foolishness. You say, you know, is that just childish play? What parent hasn't got great joy from a child's play and the things that they get up to? My child came charging into my study today in the midst of these studies and said, Daddy, are you a Christian? And my wife came in and I said, well, what does she mean? You know, I thought, have I failed, Lord, so far? She said, she was standing looking at your graduation picture with your robes on and she thinks that you're a minister. Who but couldn't get fun out of that? A car drove up the other day beside our car. I wasn't in the car at the time. And my child and another little child were sitting in the car. And this minister was driving the car. And the wee boy turned to my little girl. As she says, she's going to marry him when she grows up. And I said, well, he's 7 and you're 6. She said, don't worry, Dad. By the time we get married, you'll be dead. And this child, that's absolutely true, this child turned to my child and said, that's what your daddy is. He's a minister, isn't he? Oh no, my little girl said, no. Not like that. Oh, he said, I know what he is. He's the prime minister. Not yet, Tom, not yet. Who but couldn't enjoy that? But that is not what the word foolishness means in this wonderful chapter. It is not childishness, which is so delightful and which is such great fun. I mean, my children were going to the swimming pool the other day and Kerry shouted at Claire, Claire, keep quiet. quiet, will you? You're giving me a sore throat. Beautiful. Lovely. But that is not foolishness. That is childishness, which is delightful. In fact, I've enjoyed it so much, I've bought a book and I'm writing them all down as they say them to read at their wedding day or something, if they ever get round to it. You see what I'm driving at? You wouldn't punish a child for childishness. Foolishness includes all of the sins for which a child is capable. And a child is capable of lying. A child is capable of deceit. A child is capable of willfulness. A child is capable of perverseness. You see, if a child be punished for falsehood to avoid future punishment, he abstains and speaks the truth because he's punished, not because he's obeying God, but he's punished by his parents if he lies. It's childishness, which is delightful. In fact, I've enjoyed it so much, I've bought a book and I'm writing them all down as they say them to read at their wedding day or something, if they ever get round to it. You see what I'm driving at? You wouldn't punish a child for childishness. Foolishness includes all of the sins for which a child is capable. And a child is capable of lying. A child is capable of deceit. A child is capable of willfulness. A child is capable of perverseness. You see, if a child be punished for falsehood to avoid future punishment, he abstains and speaks the truth because he's punished, not because he's obeying God, but he's punished by his parents if he lies. Then he abstains because he doesn't want to be punished again. And then as he grows older, as he advances, he finds the blessing and comfort of the right path. He finds that it is better not to lie. And he learns gradually to speak truth from a higher motive as he grows older. And insensibly, his conscience acquires tenderness, respecting this matter of telling the truth, and it becomes a principle in his character. And this rod of correction performs its work with a permanent benefit. Of course, we must reassure and teach after that rod of correction has been applied and that punishment has been applied. You must reassure and teach after the confrontation is over. You have a confrontation, you have laid down a punishment, you apply the punishment. But after that time of conflict, it is very important, especially in little children between the age of 2 and 7, and even older. It is very important that youngster wants to be reassured that you still love it, and reassured that you are still its friend. So by all means, after the confrontation, and after it has got in, open your arms and let him or her come. I have found this as a parent to be very important. You must reassure. I remember on one occasion my mother spanking me. She did on many occasions, may I add. But on this occasion she spanked me and I was so mad. I said, right, mother, I'm going into the sitting room and I'm getting down behind the sofa and I'm never coming out. In 10 million years, I am never coming out again. And I was determined to stay there for 10,000 years. And as a little boy, I crawled in behind the sofa and I lay there for an hour. An hour and a half. And then I smelt that, I was going to say almost divine smell, but I don't mean that. That beautiful smell of chips being fried. And I thought, no, I'm not coming out. Not in 10,000 years. But it overpowered me and I came crawling out slowly down the corridor into the kitchen, up onto a chair till I reached my mother, threw my arms around her and kissed her and had the most delicious feed of chips I've had in all of my life. See, my mom was a wise woman. Parents know the way to reassure their child. Hold them close and tell them you love them. And that moment of communication builds love and fidelity and family unity. One of my children After such a time in this last week of confrontation and punishment, one of my children, she always does this every time I punish her. About an hour later, she puts her head round and she looks at me and she says, "Daddy, I'm still your friend." And £10 million wouldn't pay me for hearing her say that. And of course I take her in my arms and say, "I'm still your friend too, love. I love you whenever you are bad, and I love you whenever you are good. I love you at both times. But you must not disobey." You see, the little one, I have seen that happen. The little one desperately wants to be reassured that you still love them. And we must, when we are administering punishment, we must avoid impossible demands. Point E on your note sheet. Be absolutely sure that your child is capable of delivering what you require. For example, please never punish your child for doing poorly in school when they are incapable of academic success. Don't punish them for that. That is a very foolish thing. Impossible demands put a child in an unresolvable conflict. It is not possible for him or her to deliver to the academic standard perhaps that you have set. You must not punish them in that realm. There's no way out for a child like that, and irreparable damage has been done in that area. That condition brings inevitable damage to their whole emotional apparatus. Don't make impossible demands. How often I have seen parents in this province bring their children up without love, but applying very strict rules from the scriptures, etc., to their lives, which are important, but don't have the love and don't spend time with them and don't have their respect. And then they grow to about 18 or 19 and they get away from home. Boy, they go stark raving mad. It is incredible what they get up to once they get a bit of freedom. Because impossible demands sometimes. The parents have even gone too far beyond what the scriptures are teaching. Making impossible demands. Trying to make a little child into a 60-year-old when it's only 16. So don't make impossible demands. And whatever you do, always let love be your guide. A relationship that's characterized by genuine love and affection is likely to be a very healthy one. And even though some parental mistakes and errors are always inevitable, and I make more than most, I'm sure. Every parent makes mistakes. But if we do it in love, and we constantly, you could not give enough love to your children. You could not love them enough, as it were. They can take all the love they can get. So don't be afraid to pour it into them at every opportunity. And with those guidelines, let's now go into the thorny bit. If foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, what's this rod of correction that will drive it far from him? This is, of course, I was going to say capital punishment. This is corporal punishment. What about corporal punishment? A famous psychologist said recently, the way to stop violence is to stop spanking children. Spanking, he said, is the first half inch on the yardstick of violence. It is followed by hitting and ultimately rape and murder and assassination. And the modeling behavior that occurs at home sets the stage. I will resort to violence when I don't know what else to do. So I'm going to have corporal punishment in my home. And he says, that's violence, and it's the parent's last resort. And it leads to violence later in life. The child starts hitting others. Now, that's one of the first main arguments against corporal punishment. It assumes that corporal punishment teaches children to hit and to hurt others. And it depicts corporal punishment as a hostile attack by an angry parent whose purpose is to damage or inflict harm on his little victim. And that kind of violence does, unfortunately, occur regularly, all too regularly, between generations. And it is tremendously destructive to children if it is done with that purpose, to inflict harm on the child and just because of anger. It is called child abuse. And there's nothing worse than that. But corporal punishment, and I think without a doubt that that's what verse number 15 is saying, the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. That is corporal punishment, if anything is. Corporal punishment in the hands of a loving parent is an entirely different thing to that, both in purpose and practice. It is a teaching tool by which harmful behavior is inhibited rather than by wrathful attempt by one person to damage another. One's an act of love, and the other, child abuse, is an act of hostility, and they are as different as day is from night. Dobson says, if your child has ever bumped his arm against a hot stove, you can bet he'll never deliberately do that again. He does not become a more violent person because the stove burnt him. In fact, he has learned a valuable lesson from the pain. Similarly, when he falls out of his high chair or smashes his finger in the door or is bitten by a grumpy dog, he learns about the physical dangers in this world. And these bumps and bruises throughout childhood are nature's way of teaching him what to treat with respect. And they don't damage his self-esteem. They don't make him vicious. They merely acquaint him with reality. And in like manner, an appropriate spanking from a loving parent provides the same service. It tells him there are not only physical dangers to be avoided, but he must steer clear of some social traps as well. Selfishness, defiance, dishonesty, unprovoked aggression, etc. Now, the second argument against corporal punishment characterizes a spanking as an absolute last resort or the final act of an exasperated parent. As such, it comes on the heel of screaming and threatening and hand-wringing and buckets of tears, and then out comes the hand. And even some who recommend corporal punishment even fall into this trap and say only use corporal punishment as a last resort when everything else has failed. Look, a spanking is to be reserved for use in response to willful defiance whenever it occurs. Full stop. It is much more effective to apply it early in the conflict while the parent's emotional apparatus is under control than after 90 minutes of scratching and clawing. Child abuse is more likely to occur when a little youngster is permitted to irritate and agitate and disobey and pout. God knows I have seen it happen for hours on end. And because of modern teaching, parents sit back and say, oh, there's nothing I can do about it. There sure is. A.W. Tozer, the great Bible preacher, said, my father was a Methodist and believed in the laying on of hands, and he sure led them on. It's terrible because if that child is allowed to go on and on and on without corporal punishment until finally the parent's anger bursts to a point of explosion. Anything can happen, and literally anything does. The third common argument against spanking comes from the findings of animal psychology. If a mouse is running in a maze, he learns much faster if the experimenter rewards his correct turns with food than he will if his incorrect choices are punished with a mild electric shock. And from this has come the incredible assumption by psychologists that punishment has little influence on human behavior. Reward them all the time. Gobs of lollipops, bubba gum, or whatever you like. Buy them whatever they like. Just keep them quiet. Let them have whatever they want. And never apply corporal punishment. And if you reward them all the time, they'll learn far better. Oh, they'd need Robbie Burns to talk to them about the wee sleek at Timmerin beastie. There's all the difference in the world between a mouse and a man. With due respects to the mice, there's all the difference in the world. It is naive to acquit a man with a mouse, simplistically. If punishment doesn't influence human behavior, why do I notice you fellas when you're going off from here, driving at night, and suddenly a police car comes up along the road, you slow down? If punishment doesn't work, then why, when I'm driving along the M1 to Dungannon or somewhere, and as I'm going along, I notice a long queue of slow-moving traffic ever so gently, and I'm in a hurry, so I go up into top gear and start passing them all and discover a cop car at the top of the queue. And I want to fall back. Why? You know that punishment influences human behavior. And if punishment has no power, then why does a well-deserved spanking often turn a little troublemaker into a sweet, loving angel? I've seen it happen. Leonardo da Vinci was around a lot longer before these men ever got going with their mice. And Leonardo da Vinci said, "He who does not punish evil commands it to be done." And of course, the fourth argument against the judicious practice of spanking comes from those who see it as damaging to the dignity and the self-worth of the child. Now, it is vital when we are applying corporal punishment that we are not cruel, that it's not vicious. I had a headmaster who applied corporal punishment to me 6 times, and he never had to do it again. 6 times on the one occasion, may I add, across the one chair. And we loved him, and some of his pupils are here tonight, and I'll guarantee they'll stand up here and say he was one of the greatest men they ever knew. And I remember on one occasion acting the idiot and kicking over an electric stove. A whole lot of us were playing around as lads. And I remember that teacher taking me by the hand to the headmaster, and he put me across that chair and gave me 6 of the best. And I broke my heart, and I thought the world had caved in. But things changed after that. Even academic records changed after that in my situation. And believe me, that wouldn't have been hard. And, he's one of the greatest characters here in Ulster. Mr. Arthur Fowether is still alive. He's written his biography, or his story rather. It's fascinating. But we didn't respect him any less because he used corporal punishment. We loved him all the more. You ask Alan Sykes, who's here tonight, who's been throughout England recently witnessing for the Lord, and he could come into this pulpit and tell you about the schools he's been in London throughout England where there is no difference between pupil and teacher. You wouldn't know the difference because they both act the same. You ask Alan what it's like, he says it is incredible where discipline is broken down. Now, I'm not talking about vicious corporal punishment. Of course, I am talking about that which is administered in love and does not abuse the child. A short, sharp shock will do a lot than holding back and rewards and gobs of things would never do. This is why the youngster who knows he deserves a spanking appears almost relieved when it finally comes. And rather than being insulted and losing self-esteem by the discipline, he understands its purpose. He appreciates the control it gives him over his own impulses. You hear the story about the kid who was sitting in the restaurant one day flipping the water out of the jug at his little brother? Has that ever happened with your family? And really being nasty to his mother, spilling things and cheeky and disobeying, and his father just gave him 4 warnings. If you do that again, I'll spank you. So he did it again. If you do it again, I'll spank you. He did it again. Do it again. 4th time. So he took his son by the arm and he marched him out of the restaurant and he marched him into the car park where he proceeded to administer a spanking. And do you know, a meddling woman came charging out of the restaurant after and said, "Leave that boy alone. Let him go. If you don't stop, I'll call the police." And the 5-year-old boy, who had been crying and jumping, immediately stopped yelling and said to his father in surprise, "What's wrong with that woman, Dad?" Absolutely true. Corporal punishment is, of course, not the only tool for use in shaping the will. It's not the only one, nor is it appropriate at all ages. For all situations. It is not the answer for all situations and every situation. But there are times, according to this verse, when it is vital, the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. This foolishness that's bound like a chain in the heart of a child. The wise parent must understand the physical and the emotional characteristics of each stage in childhood and then fit the discipline to a boy or girl's individual needs. Now, I recommend Dobson's book for those of you who are parents, Faith Mission Bookshop. Here we go again, but other Christian bookshops, Cross the Road Methodist Bookshop, I'm sure it carries it. James Dobson, Discipline While You Can. And he goes into it in great detail about the various stages a child goes through and administering, as he has learned in his life, punishment at various stages. I haven't time to go into that tonight. Chapter 11 and verse 29. We've dealt with the children in the house. We've dealt with the foundation of the home. Now he that troubleth his own house shall inherit the wind. And the fool shall be a servant to the wise of heart. You want to know how to wreck a home? Here's how you wreck it. Start to trouble it. You see, a home is a unity in itself. And a home that is a unity has special favor of God. Built on the fear of the Lord and love. And the correct and careful and loving application of punishment and reward as with children. But a house troubled with division comes to desolation. Want to know how to trouble a house? There was a fellow stole a Babylonish garment one day and some money, and he hid it in his tent. And he troubled the house of Israel. And he held up the work of God. See, in the home of this church, if I get out of touch with the Lord and I start to trouble this place by attitudes, I can hold up the blessing. And Joshua and his men go out to take a city and they can't take it. Why? Because Achan has sinned. His sin troubled the house. So a man called Eli and his two boys were immoral, filthy men. If ever there were two fellas, Hophni and Phinehas. But he wouldn't punish them. He wouldn't say anything to them. He wouldn't scold them. And I haven't time to read it, but you study it. 1 Samuel 15 tells you what God said to that man for not punishing his children and what happened to the work of God. And he took the blessing all away from him and he gave it to a little boy. And if there's no discipline in the house of God, some wee lad, or in the church of Christ, and as we said last week, if we don't get away from our laziness and back to really living for the Lord Jesus in this province as a whole, and thank you for doubling the prayer meeting tonight. Wonderful. 7:20 every week. Thank you for coming. Let's see as many of you can make it. Much prayer, much power. Thank you. But when we get into earnest work for God, we will find that sin has to be admitted. And has to be put out. Is there a prayerless, careless parent listening to me now? Will you please ponder your responsibility before God? Because you're liable to be a curse instead of a blessing upon your children and upon your families. What if your roots, sir, should be rottenness and your blossom go up as the dust? The fool shall be servant to the wise of heart. Did not the prodigal son go to the citizen of that country and eat his food. What a fool he was. That's the way to wreck a home. Trouble it. Don't abuse the gifts of God or neglect your Christian responsibility if God has rewarded you. Please don't and trouble God's house and trouble your own home and break your mom and dad's heart. Or break your children's heart. Chapter 14, verse 1. Every wise woman buildeth her house, but the foolish plucketh it down with her own hands. If you get the wrong wife, my dear Christian brother, she can pluck your house down, stone by stone, metaphorically speaking. You know, a wife can be a blessing or a curse to a husband. And if she's a blessing or a curse to her husband, she'll be exactly the same to her home. And a spiritual, born-again wife, who is your partner in the Lord and brought to you by God, is the very soul of your home. God knows I know that, the very soul of it. And who can estimate the worth of a Christian mother? Nobody. A Hannah, a Eunice. Who can estimate her worth? But a weak, foolish woman, what can she do? She can wreck a home. She can pluck it down with her own hands. She's idle. She's a waster. She loves pleasure. She's no forethought. She can't plan. She's got no care. She allows her children to rule the house. She neglects their souls. And their happiness is ruined. What responsibility then belongs to the marriage choice linked with the highest interests of unborn generations? And I'm standing talking to unborn generations in this service tonight. And God is speaking. Lovingly and with compassion, I warn you again about God's word about the unequal yoke. And those of you who are Christian parents, your great responsibility. And mine too. If ever there was a matter for care and prayer, this is it. It may be the undoing of you and your home, the foolish woman who plucks it down. Verse 11 of the same chapter. Verse 11, the house of the wicked shall be overthrown, but the tabernacle of the upright shall flourish. That's a wee tent belonging to a godly person will last when the great house of the wicked will fall. Isn't that wonderful? The feeblest state of the upright is more stable than the prosperity of the wicked. The very feeblest state of a saint is far more stable than the prosperity of the wicked. Your eye doesn't tell you that. Your eye says the wicked prosper and they're doing well. They have everything. Wait a while, because the great day will set it all in order. Chapter 15, verse 25. The Lord will destroy the house of the proud, but he will establish the border of the widow. Are you proud? God will destroy your house. You proud? God knoweth the proud afar off. God hates pride. And the divine administration of the divine government from heaven is to humble the proud and to exalt the humble. That's what God will do. And God will protect the widow as he did Naomi, the Shunammite woman, and others. He will establish her borders while the pride couldn't care less about the widow and the poor and those who are in poverty around them. I tell you, God hates pride. You know that proud look that people have? That mincing step, says Isaiah, of the proud woman who thinks she's it and wisdom will die with her. Watch her. God will destroy her home. Watch him. God will destroy it. Pride and God's favor do not come together. It's the humble he exalts. Verse 27 of chapter 15, he that is greedy of gain troubleth his own house, and he that hateth gifts shall live. Covetousness. God knows sometimes churches are raked with covetousness, wishing you had something that somebody else has, and you're greedy of gain, and what'll you do? You'll trouble your own house with your covetousness. It's the root of all evil. You'll trouble the home. Think of Lot. Think of Achan. Think of Saul. Think of Ahab. Think of Gehazi. The whole list of them. But the man of God, according to this verse, hates bribery. He won't have it. Abram refused the bribery of the king of Sodom. Peter refused the enticement of Simon, that man who would have bought him. And they were blessed. Did not somebody say to my friend Tom, when he came to Ireland, Tom, you'll never get on in the world if you go on with this preaching? And Tom answered, which world, sir? Chapter 27, verse 8. As a bird that wandereth from her nest, so is a man that wandereth from his place. A little bird away from her nest is in danger. And a man away from home is in danger. Has God given you a work to do? Be content to remain in it until God removes you out of it. God will bless you in it. He'll protect you. But a man wandering from the place where God has put him is a rolling stone that gathers no moss. He's always restless. He has no fixed principles. He has no employment that's constant for God. So he's in perpetual temptation. Let every man, wrote Paul, wherein he is called, therein abide with God. Would you abide in fellowship with God? Then abide in your calling. Do what God has asked you to do with all your heart. And every step of departure without a clear scriptural warrant is departure from God. And I know it's hard, brother. And I know, sister, you're having it tough and you'd long to run. God knows I'd long to run many a time. And I speak from a heart that sympathizes with you. When responsibilities for God become overwhelming and you say, I can't take any more, Lord, I can't take any more. And God says, my grace is sufficient for you. Oh, brother, sister, with all the earnestness of my heart, can I comfort you, help you, be a blessing to your heart tonight? Don't wander from where God has put you, from the nest that he's put you in. A man thus wanders from his place to his own cost. That kind of spirit's abroad in the church, you know. Lots of people, they have no spiritual home. They're always running from church to church. No church is sound enough for them. No church is wholly molded to their taste. So they never settle. They're like a wandering bird. They're always on the wing. And they're always anxious to hear from all. And as the sure result, they learn nothing. After their own lust, says Paul to Timothy, they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears. Oh, they always want fresh teaching, new insights. They're always looking for a new voice. They won't listen to the voices that God has placed there. They're always itching for others. The end of this wandering from their place is like a bird from her nest, the loss of everything valuable. They, says 2 Timothy 4, shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. And God knows many of them listen to nothing but fables. And they have no stomach for the word of God. They have wandered so much. Let's beware of tampering with the simplicity of godly steadfastness. Let's not have a wandering spirit. For a wandering spirit proves freedom, not from prejudices. They always say, well, I'm free from prejudice. I go anywhere. They show that they have no settled principles at all. Did not our Lord restrain his disciples from forbidding the man who was doing a good work? But he did not direct them to wander from their own place and go and join him and follow him. Christian establishment is the result of a spiritual balance. At home and in the church, let us do our own work well and to the glory of God. Two girls out of this class, one of them found me this week, came all the way to see Margaret and I and sat down. She said, you know, we've been listening for quite a few months now to the word of God from Proverbs and others, and we have a GB class at home and we are the leaders of that, and we've been doing a lot of badges and a lot of things, but we hadn't really been emphasizing much in the spiritual realm, and we decided that we'd start to really help the girls socially, yes, but she said we started to witness to them for the Lord, and three of them got saved. She says the minister came to us recently of our local church and said, there's a lovely spiritual atmosphere about this work. They decided that they would start where they were and give it everything for God. Are you content in your nest until God puts you out of it? You know why little birds in their nests agree? Because if they didn't, they'd fall out. Let's pray.